There is so much to say and to share that the temptation is very much like the temptation is when you sit down to do your painting. You want to say everything. and at least it's my case, and I guess I think I see that in the art of the artists that I most love and respect. The older you get, the less you try and say. And the less you try and say, the more you say. It's the trying that tends to eliminate the actual thing happening. So that if you say what it is you feel, and as you get older, you sort of begin, you know, separating those things that are important from those that are less important. You concentrate on those things that you feel, and so you say just those things, and they're very important, and it seems to come out better that way. As a young guy, I used to try in every work to justify the God-man relationship, you know. The incarnation, the resurrection, the crucifixion, the whole thing, all in one little painting, which was usually about 11 by 14. Now I paint 50 feet by 90 feet. I'm working on a mural that's 3/4 of a mile long, and it's just really very simple. I'm keeping it simple for economic reasons, but I'm finding that I don't know as much as I used to when I was little. Probably the major delight in coming to the village, which I'm sure those of you first-timers as well as those of you that have been here for a long time will recognize, is the surprise that the people here are, and the surprises that they provide. And it was totally unexpected that Bobby and John would be here. It was unexpected for me anyway, and I've just found their being here a really special gift. And I go to my room and I ponder about how I can respond to what John says. So I don't know what he's gonna do with after what I say, but he talks to me when he sits down here and talks about all of these issues. And as Bobby will attest, I need as much woman talk as possible because I'm a real pig. And I need a lot of help in that regard. But what he says about art just catches me in my particular area, and I don't mean this to be a conversation for John, and you happen to just be bystanders. Just, you know, if you want to listen to this, go ahead. But the important thing are sometimes they are delightful, and sometimes they are absolutely hilarious when you stop to think about it. John was saying, mentioning the concern of a woman in the village about having to know so much in order to get stuff out of a work of art, and he dealt with that toward the end of this morning's session. I think there was not a registration that went by in my 44 semesters at Valparaiso University in which some sweet young thing didn't come to the registration desk and start asking about philosophy of art class, which I taught for 22 years. And the question was always, every semester, same question. It was an interesting thing about being a professor. You kept getting older, but your students always stayed the same age. There was always the same young person that came up and said, "Will I have to do anything in this class?" Now, you know you know what they mean, you know. But can you imagine going to a physics professor at the registration desk and say, well, am I going to have to do anything during this class? And, you know, or any other discipline. But in art, we are somehow afraid of art. And what they meant was, of course, am I going to have to embarrass myself by doing something like art? And, you know, and if I did, are you going to put it up so that everybody sees it? And all of that, we will try and avoid that process. And we don't realize how close that process is to all the other things that we do. All the other things that we do. So when John was describing, you know, having to know more and the various layers of reality that a work of art gives, why doesn't it dawn on people that the same thing that people ask about painting ought to be asked about everything else? Everything else. I mean, when you visit a stranger, wouldn't you come away from that stranger asking, I mean, I wish I knew more? I mean, wouldn't I get more out of that person if I knew more about them? And the way John was describing paintings are the way we describe people. Some people are just an immediate turnoff. I don't want to know more. And so I'll just simply walk away and not give them a chance. Other people seem to, just the first time you meet them, it's like an old shoe. And they kind of are just so comfortable that you don't mind being around them at all. And in fact, once again, you don't care if you know more because you like what you got right off the bat. Some people you want to dig into and some people you don't. It's the same way with places. It's the same way with Holden. Our first summer here in 71, we stayed for 3 weeks. Our second summer, the next summer, we stayed for 4 weeks. The next summer, we stayed for 5 weeks. The next summer, we stayed for a year and a half. Just want to know more. I mean, if it was that much in that little time, how much more could it be with more time or with more information? There is no text without context. You cannot read a person without understanding not only your context, but theirs, and what connection that makes. You cannot look at a painting not without just knowing more about the painting, but without knowing more about yourself. Some paintings you turn off not because of the painting, but because of you. Who you are. You can go up to a work of art, it happens every time. Yeah, just that doesn't. When exhibiting a painting in the museum in St. Louis, the City Art Museum, and a little lady looking at my painting of Jesus, she's just shaking her head. Just really upset. And I walked up and I said, you know, what do you think? I was waiting for a little applause. And she said, well, that doesn't look like any Jesus I ever saw. Now stop to think about that. Just stop to think about that. The only Jesus she ever saw was given to her by somebody like me. She just liked some other artist better than she liked me. It wasn't like she didn't like art. I just didn't agree with another artist's image which she had bought into. And we will walk up to a work of art and reject it out of hand and say, that's not art. That doesn't look like art, so it can't be. But you would not go up to a stranger and say, you don't remind me of anybody, therefore you must not be anybody. You wouldn't do that. We require somehow, and I wish it wasn't true, but we require a whole different set of sensitivities when it comes to art, and if we would just use the same sensitivities that we use with everything else, we would probably get an awful lot more out of it. I did not marry Elizabeth. I did not fall in love with my wife, whom some of you know to be an incredibly gorgeous person, because she reminded me of all the other women I have ever met. I haven't the vaguest idea why she fell in love with me, but I know for a fact I didn't remind her of any of the guys she ever met either. The things you get closest to are the things that surprise you. The things you warm up to are the things that stick out, not the things that somehow fit into some gridlock. But when we shift over into art, somehow, come weal or woe, our status is quo. We've got to somehow have it repeat some motif, some recollection. Art is not an imitation of nature. Art does not duplicate life. It extends nature. It extends life. It is therefore a surprise. It is also an intensification. There is one job that is foremost in everybody's lexicon of job description for artists. There is one task that the artist has to do. I mean, you don't have to paint. You can sculpt. You don't have to draw, although you should. You know, a lot of things you don't have. One thing you have to do, and that is choose. You have to choose. Therefore, every work of art is a choice. It is not everything. It is one choice. I hope to do a Vesper tonight that will knock your socks off. And it'll probably scare the bejeebers out of you. And all it is art. Really, all it is art. And it is very representational art. And you will know exactly everything that it means. And it will scare you. The Bible is not everything that happened. If instead of writing the Gospels when they were written, we did it now, and to Golgotha we took a video camera instead of a Gospel writer. And we even had smell-o-vision. I mean, we got it. We got it so that you could see the poor. The flesh peeling off of the flayed body of God. The stench of blood and urine. The horses, the dust, the screaming, the crying. You got the whole picture. Okay? What does that whole reality come down to in the Gospels? A couple lines. The art of the Gospels is not duplicating reality, it's choosing an element of reality and saying, this was what that event was all about. And the whole culmination of that, as far as I'm concerned, is when the centurion and those around standing under the cross said, surely, surely this was the Son of God. That's the condensation, the selection, the reduction. And that's what you look at. And Matthew's choice is different than Mark's, whose is different than Luke's, whose is different from John's. We all choose. We all have choices. There is no uninformed passage in the Bible. Everything is informed by the person that wrote it. Everything. And it is additionally informed by the people who read it. The French have a good combination. We don't. The relationship between knowing and seeing, voir and savoir, they are connected. They are very connected. You know and you see on the basis of what you know, and nobody knows what you know, and therefore nobody sees what you see. And that's the truth. Not just psychologically, but physiologically, nobody sees what you see. Because seeing what you want to see is a physiological act. The process of seeing is the process of choosing. If in all your puritanical backgrounds like mine, oh, my mother, I'm glad she wasn't here to see this morning. Skin, acres of skin. Gosh, and it wasn't enough. I mean, you had to enlarge it, you know. Some of those things were twice actual size. Oh, my mom would, you know. You can't tell me she's going to look at that stuff the way I look at that stuff. I came home, my first day in art school happened to be life drawing class. I was so proud. I brought these charcoal drawings home to show my mother. She says, "We ain't paying for that." That's a fact. That's a fact. Just wait till your father comes home. I mean, our model was a black earth mother, you know. Oh, my goodness. She, you know, I couldn't get her all on the page. Oh, my poor little eyes, just, you know, oh my God, she's going to take it all, there it goes. Oh no, I looked around, how many are going through this for the first time, you know, and having to take that home to my mother. And my father came home and boy, that's the only time I ever heard them argue, ever. Ever in 53 years, I never heard them argue except that one time, and all Papa said was, "Now, Dorothy." That was it. That was it. We see with our own informed eyes. Okay? One other thought. Just one other thought. As we prepare for new churches, I think the biggest tyranny, and in fact probably the terrorism of our time, is the terrorism of the new, of things that are new. Don't some of you feel like you are just out of it? like whatever we're going through sure doesn't involve me. And, of course, if it is new, if it is not even up to date, but it is the next thing, this is what's coming next. I just love that. Well, here it is. What do you mean it's coming next? This is the next biggie. You know, doesn't that somehow mean that you are old? I mean, not just age, but in your head, you are old. And isn't that pejorative? Haven't we made old in mind, old in body, somehow an evil that we just simply have to put up with? It's terror. It is a form of terrorism. And we got to fight it with all our hearts. Never thought that until I felt myself getting old. But it's a fact. It is an absolute fact. So when we talk about new churches, we're talking essentially about new design, some ideas that may be new, but we still got the church. And we have to understand what we mean by church in order to determine whether or not we are really talking new structures, new skin, or whether we're talking a whole new theology. All right? When my congregations that ask me to work with them say, Rich, you can do whatever you want. Just give us a church that looks like a church. Well, first of all, we sort of have to go around and say, you know, with what information do your eyes tell you a church looks like? You know, you tell me what a church looks like. And after all of that's done, I get out my slides. And we start with the catacombs. Oh, come on, not that. Well, you know, that's what a church looked like to thousands of people. Well, no, come on. And then we'll go to the Hagia Sophia, Byzantine, square acres of gold mosaic. Come on, Kimmerer, you know what the budget is. We can't swing for that puppy. How about the Romanesque, you know, with those that dog? Remember the dog on the front of the church? How about putting one of them puppies on the front of your church? That's what a church looks like. At least it looked like that in that particular time, you know. Well, no. Then we get to the Gothic cathedral. Yeah! That's what we want. That's what we want, only much smaller. See, they just don't make churches anymore like they used to. They just don't. And it's not because of the budget. It's because of the church. The nature of the church. And we'll talk about that a little bit and how that has changed the images and the space and so forth that we drop over our places of worship. You are afraid of making an aesthetic judgment for fear you'll be called a fool. You never took an art appreciation course, and so you don't know what means. You don't know the proper terminology. If I say I'd really like to go for the controlled objectification of feeling here, or the juxtaposition of plastic entities, or figure ground juxtaposition would be also good, you'd say Kimmerer's in another thing. But that's not true. There is not one of you here that, looking at this building and knowing that it is a church, doesn't have some kind of reaction. And I bet you it's probably negative. It is probably negative. What we are struggling with in the 20th century are the excesses of the Baroque and the Rococo age. The Baroque, with all the little plaster putties, these little bread dough butt babies hanging around in the ceiling, blowing trumpets and carrying spears, looking like your Aunt Pauline's attic. You know, that everything was full. They suffered from what we call a horrors vacui, a fear of empty places. You know, we still have that. We still suffer from that fear, and I'll prove it to you. But in order to rebel against that, to struggle against that, we went the whole opposite direction. And now we have emptiness. What some of the architects of the liturgical renewal called sacred space. But we're not quite sure what sanctifies it. This is obviously pre-aerosol camp. I can't imagine a wall this nifty staying like this without some scribbling going on eventually, and it's, as you can see, in the middle of an urban area. The door is on the other side. I hope. There's a moat around this thing. See that little bridge? It's probably Missouri Synod. You haven't got the right card. The floor opens up and you fall down in the moat. Listen, I can say Missouri Synod. I am Missouri Synod, so don't, you know, I'm not picking on people that I don't know. So what is this? So like a silo? Except that in our time, it's maybe not so much a grain silo as a missile silo. I think when the balloon goes up, that roof slides back and missiles come out of there. That's a what does that say? What does that say to the community? You know, give us a church that looks like a church, Kimmerer. I won't tell you which of these are mine. I expect every time I go to Cologne, Germany, that I'm going to see little ones of these up and down the block. I think she looks pregnant to me. She looks like she's going to have little baby churches all over the place. Very, just busting. Just about ready to give birth to little baby churches. One of the new feelings in church design that we're trying to get across to people is the idea of hospitality, which is not quite solved here with four downspouts over the front entrance. I'm not quite sure what the theology is, whether they were trying to do something with baptism or what, but it's a little strange, just a little strange. Sure.
Back up that one.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me of somebody stepping on a tin can.
Just kind of...
And it's coming, gaming in, ends are turning in.
That's not altogether far from the truth of the actual design. Because a hyperbolic paraboloid construction is very much like that. It's a warped barrel vault is what it is, technologically. And that's what you get when you step on a beer can. This is a dirigible hanger, I think, during the week. And on Sundays, it's a church. I don't know if I'd want to go in there. I'm just not sure. Ta-da! Air Force Academy Chapel. All of the buildings on this campus are those four-story high, low cubicle buildings. The chapel in this war college is this high peaked Gothic modern building, totally unrelated to the rest of the buildings, and rising out of its midst as though somehow God blessed the whole project of whatever is going on here. It is Gothic, it is just in a different skin, using different materials, stainless steel and glass, which in Colorado Springs gets very cold at night and very hot in the morning, so during morning services the whole skin of this building pops. It sounds like you're in the inside of a popcorn popper. Just incredible feeling. Beam me up, Scotty. When I first saw this, I thought they ought to have horses in liturgical colors all the way around. Just change these horses for the seasons of the church here. It's so easy, isn't it, to take pot shots? No text without context. We haven't any idea of what these people had in mind, and it's not our church. It's not ours. It was designed for a specific community at a specific place. It's one affectionately referred to as Our Lady of the Maytag.
Yes.
Yes. Which is an exact copy of St. Mary's Church in Tokyo, designed by the same architect. Now, I'll admit to this one. This is mine. And it's ugly. But I love it. It's a strange thing, and it was a strange project. This is in Saarbrücken. I don't know if some of you from have been to Germany or know that area, it's coal mining. Coal mining. And every member of this congregation is either in the management or labor in one particular mine in the Saarbrücken area. And when it came to the designing of the church, we took the building committee to the mine and decided that we would build a church that exactly duplicated the gantry, the entrance to the mine. And at the top of that pyramid, up at the top, houses a huge wheel off of which come four steel cables, and they hold the chancel floor off the ground. So the chancel floor is, in effect, the elevator into the mine. The last time I was there was at the occasion of the funeral of 51 miners. Members of this congregation, my whole building committee, lost in an explosion in the mine. This service, they had, well, we did some unusual stuff. All the lights on the walls were miners' helmets with lamps on them. And they designed the lighting for that worship service so that everything was dark except at the very top. And everyone assumed, they took all the stuff off the chancel and stacked the coffins, and everybody assumed that they were at the bottom of the mine, ready to be lifted up. And it worked, because this particular thing, in its ugliness, still dignifies and affirms the people in their daily life. Liturgia, liturgy, is not an escape from the reality of the world. Liturgy is, in a sense, that time in the week in which we are affirmed in what we do. We are lifted up. We bring bread, we bring wine, and it is the body and blood of Jesus. You got no sacrament without our labor. I'm not saying God couldn't have done it another way, just didn't. Somebody's gotta prune the vines. Somebody's got to harvest the wheat. Every Eucharist is a celebration of labor, and therefore a celebration of what we are. We can't get any wine for our communion without going down to the Safeway store. We live in a dinky little town. We go down to the Safeway store, and the lady does this magic. Oh! It's almost sacramental. She takes, I mean, for a guy, you know, living in a valley, in a mountain valley, this is really wonderful to go and get the wine, and the girl behind the counter takes it and rolls it around on her little counter, and a green light comes on. And numbers come up, and you just pay whatever the number says. It's marvelous. I'm going to do a banner someday, which is just going to be different long widths of black lines on a white background. And so when, you know, people... this will be a huge thing. It'll be like 20 feet tall. And I think the black stripes of the different widths will be velvet, so that when everybody sees it coming into church, they'll ask, how much did it cost? And I think what it'll be is the cost of it. I think that's what those black lines will represent. They will represent how much this banner costs. Because we don't get wine without it. We don't get wine without that lady doing something. If she doesn't sell us this stuff, we got no communion. Some stranger somewhere assisting us in celebrating the body and blood of Christ. That's amazing to my mind. This is not a retreat from the world. This is a lifting up of the world. Because our salvation is worked out in stuff, just stuff. obviously rural. The look of it. You can sense that. You don't have to ask. You can just sense. There are just some little visual clues that say, this is small town. Copenhagen, yeah. Some of you look through informed eyes. Now, do you know it's in Copenhagen? Now, who is it named after? And what did Grundtvig do?
He wrote hymns.
He wrote 2,000 hymns.
And he was a theologian.
That's right, but you don't even have to go past the hymns. They designed a church for Grundtvig that looks like an organ. Now, if you don't know that, obviously you're going to say, what a dumb design for a church. And Grundtvig? I mean, what's Grundtvig? That sounds like Ludafisk or, you know. Akavit.
The founder of the folk high schools.
The guy was a saint. In fact, I did a book and illustrated it. It's a gallery of uncanonized saints. It was written by Jerry Pelican, and I did the illustrations. And one of those uncanonized saints was Grundtvig, an incredible man. A lot of contemporary churches are trying to move away from building a sense of isolation, a separateness, to building a kind of relationship with the community. Now, you can like that or not. I'm not sure what the theological changes are that dictate that that's a legitimate move, to be separate from or to relate to. I sense it has something to do with evangelism. In this particular church, the chancel is a platform out in front. The narthex. The narthex is that platform, so that where you meet people is right out there in the open. They have plays. They have Wednesday noon concerts. And they close off the streets. And everybody brown bags it, and the church does some stuff for the community. Rochon, this little building is considered by many, I mean this isn't just a fluke, it's considered by many, many historians, contemporary historians, to be the most significant architecture of the 20th century. This one little building, and it happens to be a church, designed by Corbusier. It's called Notre Dame du Haut, which means Our Lady of the Heights. But it is called locally Our Lady of the Hats, because the rooftop is very reminiscent of the hats that the women wear in the village at the bottom of the hill. The architect obviously didn't have a building committee. He could just go ahead and do what he felt like doing. But it was a unique assignment. The inside of this building seats about 50 people. The outside of this building seats about 15,000. And you can say, hey, the outside of most buildings seat about 15,000. No, this is designed to be an inside-out church. That whole wall area on the right-hand side is a chancel. And people gather on the hillside during the two times a year in which they have pilgrimages to this church. And they face the chancel. That'd be a nice idea in California. Where is it, you Scandinavians?
Helsinki.
Temple Square. The church at Temple Square. This is the center of Helsinki, which rises to a hill, and the architect simply carved a hole out of the top of the hill and put a dome over the top. I'll show you the inside of it a little later on. But it is simply the top of the hill. There is nothing, I should tell you this, there is nothing we can't do architecturally. That's a little scary when you stop to think about it. And it's almost like the only thing that limits us is our imagination. It certainly isn't our technology. There's nothing we can't do. I just had a chapel design accepted to be built sometime in the future on the moon. Accepted by the NASA Space Agency. I'm not going to go up there and supervise, but I suspect that it will be built. We have built a chapel 400 feet underwater off the coast of France for a community of people who are learning to farm the ocean floor. We have built a chapel out of nothing but circulating air that can adjust to whatever temperature you want. All you have to do is make sure your extension cord is long enough. You can put the church anywhere you want. The folks wrote me and said it was a little disconcerting. The last time they had worship, they had it in the middle of the worship service, they had a hailstorm, and these balls of hail came down, and out of them, just in the middle of nothing, they just started turning at right angles. They just come down and bounce off of nothing. And it really destroyed the whole worship service. So we got to come up with a better idea. There are some things that haven't been worked out in that air wall chapel, like what do you do with bathrooms, and how do you hang pictures, stuff. This congregation said, we want to reach out, so we will put our creed on the outside of the church. And the man who lives opposite this great big green yard, this is about what he would see from his kitchen window, he sued the church and said, you're not supposed to have signs on public walls in Wichita Falls, and I want you to take it down. And the president of the congregation called and said, Rich, what do we do? And I said, take it down. And he said, well, come on, we just got it up. And we want to keep it. Talk to me about this project. And so I just started, it's like when you're testing the microphone, and you just say whatever comes into your head. So I said, we worked at 114 degrees in the shade, and the process was graffito, on which you would put one layer of colored plaster on top of another. There are four colors on this wall, so there are four layers, each a quarter of an inch, so the plaster is an inch. And the pastor, the chairman of the congregation, said, that's fine, I'll call you Tuesday night after our court session. And he called and said, we won. And I said, how come? He said, well, the judge determined that this wasn't on the wall. He said, it was the wall. The little guy that lived across the green moved. Got really angry and moved. And so I asked the congregation what they had won. I am really excited about people who will share their excitement and their hope with strangers passing by. I don't know what kind of churches you worship in, but I'll guarantee you that 90% of all your goodies are for your eyes only and not for strangers passing by. I'll bet you not too many of you spend very much money sharing the hope that is in you with people who go by on the outside. Now, I'm not saying you want to convert folks at 35 miles an hour. Just make them wonder what you're up to. That's all. This is an exciting thing. I haven't the vaguest idea what it means. All I know is that this congregation went into a pretty good expense and hired a wonderful contemporary French painter by the name of Manessier to execute this mosaic. And sometimes to me it looks like the crown of thorns, sometimes it looks like the Holy Spirit, but it looks dynamic. And I think the congregation that worships here and the pastor that leads that congregation must be a kind of a joyful, dynamic congregation. That's all. That's all I know, or that's all I feel. And that should be enough. Already it's an evangelism success. Episcopal Church of St. Paul's in Peoria, Illinois.
How tall is that?
That's about 52 feet square, and it's glass. Flash glass. So you read it. This is Paul, St. Paul in the missionary journeys. You read it in the front and you read it in the back, from the inside as well. This congregation asked me to do something on the chancel wall, and I drove up and I looked at that, and I said, obviously the chancel cannot need this, cannot need something as bad as this does. This is like going to the community. It is flipping off your neighbors is what it's doing. And so for a week I talked to the congregation and to the donor and said, you know, could we maybe do something on the front? And it took about a week to get them to change their mind. This is in Iowa. And so we came up with a design during that week of a kind of ascension over the cornfields of Iowa. And then we decided to do it in stoneware ceramic so that the brand new organ on the other side of that wall would have some protection from the elements. And we did it in their parking lot and built a walk-in kill in their parking lot and spent about 4 months on this project and had all the kids in the Sunday school coming after school to help us. Usually they wound up throwing clay at one another, but they also did some other things that were fun. And it was a big project, lots of fun. The kids did a lot of the scratching and the texturing. They even mixed the glazes. I think putting it up was more complicated than actually making it, because it was large. It's about 30 feet by 26 feet. And we put it on the wall.
How did you attach it?
We fired bolts into the ceramic. And that took a while to figure that one out. But we actually fired bolts into these flat pieces of ceramic, and then we drilled holes to accommodate those bolts, put an epoxy matrix in the holes, which was what they used to fasten the tiles onto the space shuttle, and set them in there. And they're in very, very solid. It's gone through 3 Iowa winters.
No.
No. Sometimes I get subtle, but never that subtle. No, this is what we did because we didn't like that blank wall.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, am I glad you asked. Very important. And the town was so excited that they put flood lamps on the power pole across the street. And at night, it's really a fun thing. And if you know Iowa, you're really able to see this from both coasts. Oh, sorry. Ooh, dear. Can we talk? My gosh, I was born with a silver foot in my mouth. I'm sorry.
What town is this?
Oh, I knew someone would ask. Very close to Des Moines. I'll think of it. I have to not try and remember it for 7 minutes, and it will come to me. Most of the church history that we are accustomed to, and we are heir to, builds a church in order for it to be the Domus Dei, the house of God. That's a common term to refer to our worship places, the house of God. The general theological difference between that and what we are trying to work on now is that we are now building the Domus Ecclesia, which is the house of God's people. The Domus Dei was always designed to create a sense of order and a sense of progression and a sense of an ultimate destiny, an ultimate location. That location, that final goal, was always the wall, the east wall. All the goodies in most of our churches is on the east wall. All right? So we focus on the wall, and we try and refurbish our facilities to make them worthy of a house for God. So we give it our best shot. The new direction is that we focus on the actions of people so that the building tends to look unfinished unless there are people in it. The problem is, as we got from the Domus Dei to the Domus Ecclesia, there was an in-the-middle part in which we were building Domus Deis, houses of God, that looked incomplete. And they tend to look like places where autopsies should be held rather than celebrations. They tend to look very clinical and precise. But the wall, the east wall, is still the focus. This is Our Lady of the Hymn Board. kind of 20th century American penal. Concrete block. This is finish. And I'm not going to go into that. You know who you are. The church in Finland is 94% Lutheran, and the church in Finland has asked me to come and consult with local artists and architects in Finland, and there are incredible craftspeople, and see whether or not the new churches cannot use some of the crafts, like the rugs, the carvings, ceramics, and so forth. My first shot was rather disappointing because these buildings are so precise and so perfect that if you hung a nice carving or something on that wall, the whole church would kind of change, tip over even maybe. Look at this. We make little rules and then we respond stupidly. You can't have an altar anymore against the wall, so we bring the altar out. And then we put bushes all over it so that the pastor has to kind of, you know, go around in order to see the people out there. There's a space between there and there, but nobody's going to walk behind there, for crying out loud. This whole space from here to here, from here to here, is designed for one person. One of the big pop words in contemporary church design is accessibility. Usually that means for the handicapped, can wheelchair folks get it into there? But for me, accessibility means, can anybody go where the pastor goes? Can anybody go where the pastor goes? And here, this whole space is designed for one person. Nobody's going to help that guy. I mean, you one step back and you've compacted your vertebrae. So he's got to run up and down. Back and forth to the communion rail down here. Runs over here to preach. All of that space, just for the one person. It's not a Domus Ecclesia. That's where I worshiped for 22 years. You needed a program to just understand what was going on the wall. Sure made the service go fast, though. Emphasis on that wall. That wall, Coventry Cathedral. The whole focus, not on people, but on the wall. Flexibility is another buzzword in contemporary church design. So we go for chairs instead of pews. Can you imagine telling the sexton of this church that next Sunday we'd like to do something in the round? You know, we got the chairs. We got 2,800 chairs. Just put them in a big circle. The guy would probably go into cardiac arrest. And would that look stupid? With that all that stuff against the east wall and everybody gathered around in a circle? Would really look dumb. To show you the extent of the east wall mentality, and some of you may use this. This is a free advice for those of you that want to enlarge your church and have no money at all. Here's a little tiny church that the pastor wanted to enlarge, And so we painted an enlargement on the east wall. I mean, he's got St. Peter's attached to the end of that thing. Look at that. Isn't that wonderful? I just love it. That's all as flat as the back of your hand and only costs $5.48 a gallon. Boy, there, the wall never ends. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going. Up in the Northwest, we do this a lot because we got such beautiful scenery. You know, that's why nobody goes to church in Washington. That's right. We are the lowest percentage of church-affiliated people in all 50 states, the state of Washington. They're all out there lifting their eyes up unto the hills, you know. And I hate this. I just hate this. It's so beautiful. Everybody walking in looking at the surf. If you're going to look at the view, just you don't have to build a building to look in the view. Just stay in the parking lot and look at the view. The reason you have come into church, in fact, and I'm getting maybe a little radical in my old age, you don't even have to go to church to get baptized. Our little baby Stephen was baptized with water from the drinking fountain on the second floor of Porter Memorial Hospital in Valparaiso, Indiana. And we didn't say when things were getting tough for Stephen, well, quick, gotta get him over to church. We said, quick, gotta get him over to the water. And I'm gonna dance with that little guy in heaven shortly. The pastor will make house calls. Call in sick. He'll bring the little wafer and the wine to your bedside. What can't you get unless you go to church? Each other. Each other. You don't go to church for the view. You go to church for the church. For the body. To lift up the body. To be together with each other. Because it would be hell to know that you were the last Christian in your community. You couldn't survive. But you gotta be careful how you lead the eye around. Oh man, I wish I had a lot of time to share with you folks. This is so funny. I mean, just so much fun. We're in the middle of a worship service here, Roman Catholic service. All during the service, there's this lady going back and forth here. I mean, you're talking early Sunday morning, and you got a lady going back and forth in that window, and everybody's just kind of, you know, during the whole worship. Oh, God, no. Oh, no. Oh, no, no. She wouldn't do that. Oh, I don't know. She wouldn't. Oh, God. What if she did do it? Oh, no. We're supposed to be concentrated. Well, in the middle of the service, the guy lifts up the host, you know, big point in the church. He lifts up the host. She comes out with a yellow rug and dusts his wafer. Just all the dust coming down here. He's standing down here holding up the wafer and she's shaking it, you know. And it was like liturgy. It was like versicle and response. He held up the wafer, she dusted it, and everybody in the congregation sort of went. And the poor guy is standing up, he doesn't know what's going on behind him. Like, you know, did he forget to zip up before he came in this, you know, what is the problem out there? Did I say something wrong? We had to go to him afterwards and explain and apologize profusely, and he was a good guy. He said, well, I'm going to see her tomorrow morning, and I'm going to tell her that the next time she does that, to use the right liturgical color. We have a fetish for symmetry, an absolute fetish. That's why we got half of the junk we got in churches. Because if we don't have, if we've got a pulpit on this side and we don't have a lectern on this side, the whole church is just going to flip right over. We got seven candles, that's a good number. Seven is a good number.
But 14 doesn't mean diddly. You know what I'm saying? We even got in this church is so Lutheran. It's got two sanctuary lamps. Two! Incredible! They said to me, I bet you never saw a church with two sanctuary lamps. And I said, what does that mean? This is backwards. This slide is backwards, but it doesn't matter. I love it. That's an indictment right there. I said, what does that sanctuary lamp mean? Why do you have that? And any Lutheran will tell you that means the presence of God. That's the presence of God. I said, any of you people have one at home? No. What does that mean? We make these little things, and then we give meaning. God didn't say, you know, where two or three sanctuary lamps are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst. We ascribe meanings to these things. And then we put them in a place so as to control where God is and where God isn't. We can drive by at 2 in the morning and scope this out, and those lights are on, which means God's in there, which means we don't have to worry about running into her downtown. Domus Dei. Be careful about that. Very rigid. Hymn board. Everything. We got flag. Anybody here who has had a basic art course will know there is a good reason why we call it dead center. Dead center. In your first basic composition course, you learn about that. The only place where this design has any legitimacy is in the aisle. If you're standing in the aisle, which is where you're not supposed to be.